Hey, this me and I. And its armor wouldn't have been disabled. She would take Tuvar and 3 and 4, and as many as she had time to awaken, and try to take either the central access deck or the engines. More likely, both. She had, after all, Var and every hold below it. Though the segments would be clumsy and confused, they would have no memory of functioning apart the way I had, no practice. But numbers were on her side. I had only the segments that had been awake at the moment I fragmented. Above, my officers had access to the upper half of the holds, and they would have no reason not to obey Anander, me and I, no reason not to think I had lost my mind. I was at this moment explaining matters to 100 Captain Rubrin, but I had no confidence she would believe me or think me even remotely sane. Around me, the same thunking began that was sounding below my feet. My officers were pulling up ESC segments to thaw. I reached the airlock, threw open the locker beside it, pulled out the pieces of the vacuum suit that would fit this segment. I didn't know how long I could hold central access or the engines. I didn't know how desperate Anander, me and I might be, what damage she might think I could do to her. The engine's heat shield was, by design, extremely difficult to breach, but I knew how to do it, and the Lord of the Roch certainly did as well. And whatever happened between here and there, it was a near certainty I would die shortly after I reached Valsky, if not before. But I wouldn't die without explaining myself. I would have to reach and board a shuttle, and then manually undock and depart Justice of Torin, myself, at exactly the right time, at exactly the right speed, on exactly the right heading, fly through the wall of my surrounding bubble of normal space at exactly the right moment. If I did all that, I would find myself in a system with a gate, 4 jumps from E-Ray Palace, one of Anander Mianai's provincial headquarters. I could tell her what had happened. The shuttles were docked on this side of the ship. The hatches and the undocking ought to work smoothly. It was all equipment I had tested and maintained myself. Still, I found myself worrying that something would go wrong. At least it was better than thinking about fighting my own officers, or the heat shields failing. I fastened my helmet. My breath hissed loud in my ears, faster than it should have. I forced myself to slow my breathing, deepen it. Hyperventilating wouldn't help. I had to move quickly, but not so hastily that I made some fatally foolish mistake. Waiting for the airlock to cycle, I felt my aloneness like an impenetrable wall pressing around me. Usually, one body's off-kilter emotion was a minor, easily dismissible thing. Now, it was only this one body, nothing beyond to temper my distress. The rest of me was here, all around, but inaccessible. Soon, if things went right, I wouldn't even be near myself or have any idea when I might rejoin it. And at this moment I could do nothing but wait, and remember the feel of the gun in one Var's hand. My hand. I was one-esque, but what was the difference? The recoil as one Var shot Lieutenant on. The guilt and helpless anger that had overwhelmed me had receded at that moment, overcome by more urgent necessity. But now I had time to remember. My next 3 breaths were ragged and sobbing. For a moment, I was perversely glad I was hidden from myself. I had to calm myself, had to clear my mind. I thought of songs I knew. My heart is a fish, I thought. But when I opened my mouth to sing it, my throat closed. I swallowed, breathed, thought of another one. Oh, have you gone to the battlefield, armored and well-armed? And shall dreadful events force you to drop your weapons? The outer door opened. If me and I hadn't used her device, officers on duty would have seen that the lock had opened, would have notified Captain Rubrin, drawing me and I's attention. But she had used it, and she had no way of knowing what I did. I reached around the doorway for a handhold and pulled myself out. Looking at the inside of a gateway often made humans queasy. It had never bothered me before, but now I was nothing but a single human body. I found it did the same to me. Black, but a black that seemed simultaneously an unthinkable depth into which I might fall, was falling, and a suffocating closeness ready to press me into non-existence. I forced myself to look away. Here, outside, there was no floor, no gravity generator to keep me in place and give me an up and down. I moved from one handhold to the next. What was happening behind me, inside the ship that was no longer my body? It took 17 minutes to reach a shuttle, operate its emergency hatch, and perform a manual undock. At first, I fought the desire to halt, to look behind me, to listen for the sounds of someone coming to stop me. Never mind, I couldn't have heard anything outside my own helmet. Just maintenance, I told myself. Just maintenance outside the hull. You've done it hundreds of times. If anyone came, I could do nothing. Esk would have failed. I would have failed. And my time was limited. I might not be stopped and still fail. I couldn't think of any of that. When the moment came, I was ready and away. My view was limited to fore and aft, the only two hardwired cameras on the shuttle. As Justice of Torin receded in the aft view, the rising sense of panic that I had mostly held in check till now overtook me. What was I doing? Where was I going? What could I possibly accomplish alone and single-bodied, deaf and blind and cut off? What could be the point of defying Anander me and I, who had made me, who owned me, who was unutterably more powerful than I would ever be? I breathed. I would return to the Roch. I would eventually return to Justice of Torin, even if only for the last moments of my life. My blindness and deafness were irrelevant. There was only the task before me. There was nothing to do but sit in the pilot's chair and watch Justice of Torin get smaller and farther away. Think of another song. According to the chronometer, if I had done everything exactly as I should, Justice of Torin would disappear from my screen in 4 minutes and 32 seconds. I watched, counting, trying not to think of anything else. The aft view flashed bright, blue-white, and my breath stopped. When the screen cleared, I saw nothing but black and stars. I had exited my self-made gate. I had exited more than 4 minutes too soon. And what had that flash been? I ought only to have seen the ship disappear, the stars suddenly spring into existence. Me and I hadn't attempted to take central access or join forces with the officers on the upper decks. The moment she realized I had already fallen to her enemy, she must have resolved immediately to take the most desperate course available to her. She and what VAR ancillaries she had serving her had taken my engines and breached the heat shield. How I had escaped and not vaporized along with the rest of the ship, I couldn't account for. But there had been that flash, and here I still was. Justice of Torin was gone, and all aboard it. I wasn't where I was supposed to be, might be unreachably distant from Roch space or any human worlds at all. All possibility of being reunited with myself was gone. The captain was dead. All my officers were dead. Civil war loomed. I had shot Lieutenant On. Nothing would ever be right again. Chapter 17. Luckily for me, I had come out of gate space on the fringes of a backwater, non-Rodchai system. A collection of habitats and mining stations, inhabited by heavily modified people, not human by Rodchai standards, people with 6 or 8 limbs, and no guarantee any of them would be legs, vacuum-adapted skin and lungs, brains so meshed and cross-hatched with implants and wiring, it was an open question whether they were anything but conscious machines with a biological interface. It was a mystery to them that anyone would choose the sort of primitive form most humans I knew were born with. But they prized their isolation, and it was a dearly held tenet of their society that, with a few exceptions, most of which they wouldn't actually admit to, one didn't ask for anything a person didn't volunteer. They viewed me with a combination of puzzlement and mild contempt, and treated me as though I were a child who had wandered into their midst, and they might keep half an eye on me until my parents found me, but really I wasn't their responsibility. If any of them guessed my origin, and surely they did, the shuttle alone was enough. They didn't say so, and no one pressed me for answers, something they would have found appallingly rude. They were silent, clannish, self-contained, but they were also brusquely generous at unpredictable intervals. I would still be there, or dead, if not for that. I spent 6 months trying to understand how to do anything. Not just how to get my message to the Lord of the Roch, but how to walk and breathe and sleep and eat as myself. As a myself that was only a fragment of what I had been, with no conceivable future beyond eternally wishing for what was gone. Then one day, a human ship arrived, and the captain was happy to take me on board in exchange for what little money I had left from scrapping the shuttle, which had been running up docking charges I couldn't pay otherwise. I found out later that a 4-meter tentacled eel of a person had paid the balance of my fare without telling me, because, she had told the captain, I didn't belong there and would be healthier elsewhere. Odd people, as I said, and I owe them a great deal, though they would be offended and distressed to think anyone owed them anything. In the 19 years since then, I had learned 11 languages and 713 songs. I had found ways to conceal what I was, even, I was fairly sure, from the Lord of the Roch herself. I had worked as a cook, a janitor, a pilot. I had settled on a plan of action. I had joined a religious order and made a great deal of money. In all that time, I only killed 12 people. By the time I woke the next morning, the impulse to tell Savard in anything had passed, and she seemed to have forgotten her questions, except one.
"So where next?"
she asked it casually, sitting on the bench by my bed, leaning against the wall, as though she were only idly curious about the answer. When she heard, maybe she'd decide she'd like it better on her own. "Aumaw Palace." She frowned just slightly.
"That a new one?"
"Not particularly. It had been built 700 years ago. But after Gar said yes." My right ankle began to tingle and itch, a sure sign the corrective was finished. "You left Rodchai space unauthorized, and you sold your armor to do it."
"Extraordinary circumstances," she said, still leaning back. "I'll appeal."
"That'll get you a delay, at any rate." Any citizen who wanted to see the Lord of the Roch could apply to do so, though the farther one was from a provincial palace, the more complicated, expensive, and time-consuming the journey would be. Sometimes applications were turned down, when the distance was great and the cause was judged hopeless or frivolous, and the petitioner was unable to pay her own way. But Anandamayini was the final appeal for nearly any matter, and this case was certainly not routine. And she would be right there on the station. You'll wait months for an audience. Savardhan gestured her lack of concern.
What are you going to do there?
Try to kill Anandamayini. But I couldn't say that. See the sights, buy some souvenirs, maybe try to meet the Lord of the Roch. She lifted an eyebrow, then she looked at my pack. She knew about the gun, and of course she understood how dangerous it was. She still thought I was an agent of the Roch.
Undercover the whole way? And when you hand that,
she shrugged toward my pack,
over to the Lord of the Roch, then what?
I don't know. I closed my eyes. I could see no further than arriving at Amaw Palace. Hadn't even the remotest shadow of an idea of what to do after that, how I might get close enough to Anandamayini to use the gun. No, that wasn't true. The beginning of a plan had this moment suggested itself to me. But it was horribly impractical, relying as it did on Savardhan's discretion and support. She had constructed her own idea of what I was doing and why I would return to the Roch, playing a foreign tourist. Why I would report directly to Anandamayini instead of a special missions officer. I could use that.
I'm coming with you, Savardhan said. As though she had guessed my thoughts, she added, You can come to my appeal and speak on my behalf.
I didn't trust myself to answer. Pins and needles traveled up my right leg, started in my hands, arms, and shoulders, and my left leg. A slight ache began in my right hip. Something hadn't healed quite right.
It's not as if I don't already know what's going on, Savardhan said.
So when you steal from me, breaking your legs won't be enough. I'll have to kill you. My eyes still closed. I couldn't see her reaction to that. She might well take it as a joke.
I won't, she answered. You'll see.
I spent several more days in Therid recovering sufficiently that the doctor would approve my leaving. All that time, and afterward all the way up the ribbon, Savardhan was polite and deferential. It worried me. I had stashed money and belongings at the top of the Nilt ribbon and would have to retrieve them before we left. Everything was packaged, so I could do that without Savardhan seeing much more than a couple of boxes, but I had no illusions she wouldn't try to open them first chance she got. At least I had money again, and maybe that was the solution to the problem. I took a room on the ribbon station, left Savardhan there with instructions to wait, and went to recover my possessions. When I returned, she was sitting on the single bed, no linens or blankets, that was conventionally extra here, fidgeting. One knee bouncing, rubbing her upper arms with her bare hands. I had sold our heavy outer coats and the gloves at the foot of the ribbon. She stilled when I came in and looked expectantly at me but said nothing. I tossed into her lap a bag that made a tumbling, clicking sound as it landed. Savardhan gave it one frowning look and then turned her gaze to me, not moving to touch the bag or claim it in any way.
What's this?
10,000 shen, I said. It was the most commonly negotiable currency in this region, in easily transportable and spent chits. 10,000 would buy a lot here. It would buy passage to another system with enough left over to binge for several weeks.
Is that a lot?
Yes. Her eyes widened just slightly, and for half a second I saw calculation in her expression. Time for me to be direct. The room is paid up for the next 10 days. After that, I gestured at the bag on her lap. That should last you a while, longer if you're truly serious about staying off Kef. But that look, when she'd realized she had access to money, made me fairly certain she wasn't. Not really. For 6 seconds, Savardin looked down at the bag in her lap.
No.
She picked the bag up gingerly, between her thumb and forefinger, as though it were a dead rat, and dropped it on the floor.
I'm coming with you.
I didn't answer, only looked at her. Silence stretched out. Finally, she looked away, crossed her arms.
Isn't there any tea?
Not the sort you're used to.
I don't care.
Well, I didn't want to leave her here alone with my money and possessions. Come on, then. We left the room, found a shop on the main corridor that sold things for flavoring hot water. Savardin sniffed one of the blends on offer, wrinkled her nose.
This is tea?
The shop proprietor watched us from the corner of her vision, not wanting to seem to watch us. I told you it wasn't the sort you were used to. You said you didn't care. She thought about that a moment. To my utter surprise, instead of arguing or complaining further about the unsatisfactory nature of the tea in question, she said calmly,
"What do you recommend?"
I gestured my uncertainty. I'm not in the habit of drinking tea.
Not in the...
She stared at me.
Oh, don't they drink tea in the Gerentate?
Not the way you people do. And of course tea was for officers. For humans. Ancillaries drank water. Tea was an extra unnecessary expense, a luxury. So I had never developed the habit. I turned to the proprietor, a Nilter, short and pale and fat, in shirt sleeves, though the temperature here was a constant 4°C, and Savardin and I both still wore our inner coats. Which of these has caffeine in it? She answered pleasantly enough, and became pleasanter when I bought not only 250 grams each of two kinds of tea, but also a flask with two cups and two bottles, along with water to fill them. Savardin carried the whole lot back to our lodging, walking alongside me, saying nothing. In the room, she laid our purchases on the bed, sat down beside them, and picked up the flask, puzzling over the unfamiliar design. I could have showed her how it worked, but decided not to. Instead, I opened my newly claimed luggage and dug out a thick golden disc, 3 centimeters larger in diameter than the one I had carried with me, and a small, shallow bowl of hammered gold, 8 centimeters in diameter. I closed the trunk, set the bowl on it, and triggered the image in the disc. Savardin looked up to watch it unfold into a wide, flat flower in mother-of-pearl. A woman standing in its center. She wore a knee-length robe of the same iridescent white, inlaid with gold and silver. In one hand, she held a human skull, itself inlaid with jewels, red and blue and yellow, and in the other hand, a knife.
That's like the other one, Savardin said, sounding mildly interested. But it doesn't look so much like you.
True, I answered, and sat cross-legged before the trunk.
Is that a Gerentate god?
It's one I met traveling. Savardin made a breathy non-committal noise.
What's its name?
I spoke the long string of syllables which left Savardin nonplussed. It means she who sprang from the lily. She is the creator of the universe. This would make her Amat in Radchai terms.
Ah,
said Savardin, in a tone I knew meant she'd made that equation, made the strange god familiar, and brought it safely within her mental framework.
And the other one?
A saint.
What a remarkable thing that she should resemble you so much.
Yes, although she's not the saint, the head she's holding is. Savardin blinked, frowned. It was very un-Radchai.
Still.
Nothing was just a coincidence, not for Radchai. Such odd chances could, and did, send Rodchai on pilgrimages, motivate them to worship particular gods, change entrenched habits. They were direct messages from Amat.
"I'm going to pray now," I said.
With one hand, Saevardin made a gesture of acknowledgement. I unfolded a small knife, pricked my thumb, and bled into the gold bowl. I didn't look to see Saevardin's reaction. No Rodchai god took blood, and I hadn't troubled to wash my hands first. It was guaranteed to lift Rodchai eyebrows, to register as foreign and even primitive. But Saevardin didn't say anything. She sat silent for 31 seconds as I intoned the first of the 322 names of the Hundred of White Lily, and then she turned her attention to the flask and making tea. Saevardin had said she'd lasted 6 months at her last attempt to quit Kef. It took 7 months to reach a station with a Rodchai consulate. Approaching the first leg of the journey, I had told the purser in Saevardin's hearing that I wanted passage for myself and my servant. She hadn't reacted, that I could see. Perhaps she hadn't understood. But I had expected a more or less angry recrimination in private when she discovered her status. And she never mentioned it. And from then on, I woke to find tea already made and waiting for me. She also ruined 2 shirts, attempting to launder them, leaving me with 1 for an entire month until we docked at the next station. The ship's captain, she was Key, tall and covered in ritual scars, let fall in an oblique, circuitous way that she and all her crew thought I'd taken Saevardin on as a charity case. Which wasn't far from the truth. I didn't contest it. But Saevardin improved, and 3 months later, on the next ship, a fellow passenger tried to hire her away from me. Which wasn't to say she had suddenly become a different person, or entirely deferential. Some days she spoke irritably to me, for no reason I could see, or spent hours curled in her bunk, her face to the wall, rising only for her self-imposed duties. The first few times I spoke to her when she was in that mood, I only received silence in reply, so after that I left her alone. The Rodchai consulate was staffed by the translator's office, and the consular agent's spotless white uniform, including pristine white gloves, argued she either had a servant or spent a good deal of her free time attempting to appear as though she did. The tasteful and expensive-looking jeweled strands wound in her hair, and the names on the memorial pins that glittered everywhere on the white jacket, as well as the faint disdain in her voice when she spoke to me, argued servant. Though likely only one, this was an out-of-the-way posting.
"As a visiting non-citizen, your legal rights are restricted." It was clearly a rote speech. "You must deposit at minimum the equivalent of..."
Fingers twitched as she checked the exchange rate.
500 shen per week of your visit, per person. If your lodging, food, and any extra purchases, fines, or damages exceed the amount on deposit, and you cannot pay the balance, you will be legally obligated to take an assignment until your debt is paid. As a non-citizen, your right to appeal any judgment or assignment is limited. Do you still wish to enter Raj space?
"I do," I said, and laid 2 million shen chits on the slim desk between us. Her disdain vanished. She sat slightly straighter and offered me tea, gesturing slightly, fingers twitching again as she communicated with someone else, her servant, it turned out, who, with a slightly harried air, brought tea in an elaborately enameled flask and bowls to match. While the servant poured, I brought out my forged Gerentate credentials and placed those on the desk as well.
"You must also provide identification for your servant, honored," said the consular agent, now all politeness.
"My servant is a Rodchai citizen," I answered, smiling slightly. meaning to take the edge off what was going to be an awkward moment. But she's lost her identification and her travel permits. The consular agent froze, attempting to process that.
The honored Breck, said Savardin, standing behind me, in antique, effortlessly elegant radchai, has been generous enough to employ me and pay my passage home.
This didn't resolve the consular agent's astonished paralysis quite as effectively as Savardin perhaps had wished. That accent didn't belong on anyone's servant, let alone a non-citizen's. And she hadn't offered Savardin a seat or tea, thinking her too insignificant for such courtesies.
Surely you can take genetic information, I suggested. Yes, of course, answered the consular agent with a sunny smile, though your visa application will almost certainly come through before citizen...
Savardin, I supplied.
Before citizen Savardin's travel permits are reissued, depending on where she departed from and where her records are.
Of course, I answered and sipped my tea.
That's only to be expected.
As we left, Savardin said to me in an undertone,
What a snob! Was that real tea?
It was. I waited for her to complain about not having had any, but she said nothing more.
It was very good.
What are you going to do if an arrest order comes through instead of travel permits? She made a gesture of denial.
Why should they? I'm already asking to come back. They can arrest me when I get there, and I'll appeal. Do you think the consul has that tea shipped from home, or might someone here sell it?
Find out if you like, I said. I'm going back to the room to meditate. The consular agent's servant outright gave Savardin half a kilo of tea, likely grateful for the opportunity to make up for her employer's unintentional slight earlier. And when my visa came through, so did travel permits for Savardin, and no arrest order or any additional comment or information at all. That worried me, if only slightly, but likely Savardin was right. Why do anything else? When she stepped off the ship, there would be time and opportunity enough to address her legal troubles. Still, it was possible Roch authorities had realized I wasn't actually a citizen of the Gerentate. It was unlikely. The Gerentate was a long, long way from where I was going, and besides, despite fairly friendly, or at least not openly antagonistic, relations between the Gerentate and the Roch, as a matter of policy, the Gerentate didn't supply any information at all about its residents. Not to the Roch. If the Roch asked, and they wouldn't, the Gerentate would neither confirm nor deny that I was one of its citizens. Had I been departing from the Gerentate for Radchai space, I would have been warned repeatedly that I traveled at my own risk and would receive no assistance if I found myself in difficulties. But the Radchai officials who dealt with foreign travelers knew this already and would be prepared to take my identification, more or less, at face value. Anandamienai's 13 palaces were the capitals of their provinces. Metropolis-sized stations, each one half-ordinary large Radchai station with accompanying station AI, and half-palace proper. Each palace proper was the residence of Anandamienai and the seat of provincial administration. Alma Palace wouldn't be any sort of quiet backwater. A dozen gates led to its system, and hundreds of ships came and went each day. Savardin would be one of thousands of citizens seeking audience or making an appeal in some legal case. A noticeable one, certainly. None of those other citizens were returned from 1,000 years in suspension. I spent the months of travel considering just what I wanted to do about that, how to use it, how to counter its disadvantages or turn them to my favor. and considering just what it was I hoped to accomplish. It's hard for me to know how much of myself I remember, how much I might have known that I had hidden from myself all my life. Take, for instance, that last order, the instruction I, Justice of Torin, had given to me, 1-19. Get to Iray Palace, find Anander Mianai, and tell her what's happened. What did I mean by that? Over and above the obvious, the bare fact I'd wanted to get the message to the Lord of the Rach. Why had it been so important? Because it had been. It hadn't been an afterthought, it had been an urgent necessity. At the time it had seemed clear. Of course I needed to get the message out. Of course I needed to warn the Rite and Ander. I would follow my orders. But in the time I'd spent recovering from my own death, the time working my way toward Rach space, I had decided I would do something else as well. I would defy the Lord of the Rach. And perhaps my defiance would amount to nothing, a feeble gesture she would barely notice. The truth was, Stregan was right. My desire to kill Anander Mianai was unreasonable. Any actual attempt to do such a thing wasn't sane. Even given a gun that I could carry into the very presence of the Lord of the Rach herself without her knowing until I chose to reveal it. Even given that, all I could hope to accomplish was a pitiful cry of defiance, gone as soon as made, easily disregarded. Nothing that could possibly make any difference. But all that secret maneuvering against herself, designed certainly to avoid open conflict, to avoid damaging the Rach too badly, to avoid, perhaps, too badly fracturing Anander Mianai's conviction that she was unitary, one person. Once the dilemma had been clearly stated, could she pretend things were otherwise? And if there were now two Anander Mianais, might there not also be more? A part, perhaps, that didn't know about the feuding sides of herself? Or told herself she didn't? What would happen if I said straight out the thing the Lord of the Rach had been concealing from herself? Something dire, surely, or she wouldn't have gone to such lengths to hide herself from herself. Once the thing was open and acknowledged, how could she help tearing herself apart? But how could I say anything straight out to Anander Mianai? Granted, I could reach Amah Palace. Granted, I could leave the ship, step onto the station. If I could do that much, then I could stand in the middle of the main concourse and shout my story aloud for everyone to hear. I might begin to do that, but I would never finish. Security would come for me, maybe even soldiers, and that day's news would say a traveler had lost her mind on the concourse, but security had dealt with the situation. Citizens would shake their heads and mutter about uncivilized foreigners, and then forget all about me. And whichever part of the Lord of the Rach noticed me first could no doubt easily dismiss me as damaged and insane. Or at least, convince the various other parts of herself that I was. No, I needed the full attention of Anander Mianai when I said what I had to say. How to get it was a problem I had worried at for nearly 20 years. I knew that it would be harder to ignore someone whose erasure would be noticed. I could visit the station and try to be seen, to become familiar, so that any part of Anander couldn't just dispose of me without comment. But I didn't think that would be enough to force the Lord of the Rach, all of the Lord of the Rach, to listen to me. But Saevarden, Captain Saevarden Vendai, lost 1,000 years, found by chance, lost again. Appearing now at Amah Palace, any Rachai would be curious about that, with a curiosity that carried a religious charge. And Anander Mianai was Rachai, perhaps the most Rachai of Rachai. she couldn't help but notice that I had returned in company with Savardin. Like any other citizen, she would wonder, even if only at the back of her mind, what, if anything, that might mean. And she, being who she was, the back of her mind was a substantial thing. Savardin would ask for an audience, would be eventually granted one. And that audience would have all of Anander's attention. No part of her would ignore such an event. And surely Savardin would have the attention of the Lord of the Roch from the moment we stepped off the ship. So, arriving in Savardin's company, would I. Tremendously risky. I might not have concealed my nature well enough, might be recognized for what I was. But I was determined to try. I sat on the bunk waiting for permission to leave the ship at Aumau Palace, my pack at my feet, Savardin leaning negligently against the wall across from me, bored.
"Something's bothering you," Savardin observed, casually.
I didn't answer, and she said,
"You always hum that tune when you're preoccupied."
My heart is a fish, hiding in the water grass. I had been thinking of all the ways things could go wrong, starting now, starting the moment I stepped off the ship and confronted the dock inspectors, or station security, or worse. Thinking of how everything I had done would be for nothing if I was arrested before I could even leave the docks. I had been thinking about Lieutenant Ahn. I'm so transparent. I made myself smile as though I were mildly amused.
Not transparent, not exactly, just...
She hesitated, frowned slightly, as though she'd suddenly regretted speaking.
"You have a few habits, I've noticed, that's all."
She sighed.
"Are the dock inspectors having tea, or just waiting till we've aged sufficiently?"
We couldn't leave the ship without the permission of the inspector's office. The inspector would have received our credentials when the ship requested permission to dock, and had plenty of time to look over them and decide what to do when we arrived. Still leaning against the bulkhead, Savardin closed her eyes and began to hum. Wobbling, pitch sinking or rising by turns as she missang intervals, but still recognizable.
"My heart is a fish. Otter's tits," she swore after a verse and a half, eyes still closed. "Now you've got me doing it."
The door chime sounded. "Enter," I said. Savardin opened her eyes, sat straight, suddenly tense. The boredom had been a pose, I suspected. The door slid open to reveal a person in the dark blue jacket, gloves, and trousers of a dock inspector. She was slight and young, maybe 23 or 24. She looked familiar, though I couldn't think who it was she reminded me of. The sparser-than-usual scatter of jewelry and memorial pins might tell me, if I stared closely enough to read names, which would be rude. Across from me, Savardin tucked her bare hands behind her back. "Honored Breck," the inspector adjunct said, with a slight bow. She seemed unfazed by my own bare hands, used to dealing with foreigners, I supposed. "Citizen Savardin, would you please accompany me to the inspector supervisor's office?" And there should have been no need for us to visit the inspector supervisor herself. This adjunct could pass us on to the station on her own authority, or order our arrest. We followed her past the lock into the loading bay, past another lock into a corridor busy with people. Dock inspectors in dark blue, station security in light brown, here and there the darker brown of soldiers, and spots of brighter color, a scatter of non-uniformed citizens. This corridor opened into a wide room, a dozen guards along the walls to watch over travelers and traders, on one end the entrance to the station proper, and opposite, the doorway into the inspector's office. The adjunct escorted us through the outermost office, where 9 blue-uniformed minor adjuncts dealt with complaining ship captains, and beyond them were offices for likely a dozen major adjuncts and their crews. Past those and into an inner office with 4 chairs and a small table and a door at the back, closed.
"I'm sorry, honored and citizen," said the adjunct who had led us here,
fingers twitching as she communicated with someone, likely the station AI or the inspector supervisor herself.
"The inspector supervisor was available, but something's come up. I'm sure it won't be more than a few minutes. Please have a seat. Will you have tea?"
A reasonably long wait, then, and the courtesy of tea implied this wasn't an arrest. That no one had discovered my credentials were forged. Everyone here, including Station, would assume I was what I said I was, a foreign traveler. And possibly I would have a chance to discover just who this young inspector adjunct reminded me of. Now she'd spoken at a bit more length, I noticed a slight accent. Where was she from? "Yes, thank you," I said. Savardin didn't respond to the offer of tea right away. Her arms were folded, her bare hands tucked under her elbows. She likely wanted the tea, but was embarrassed about her ungloved hands, couldn't hide them holding a bowl. Or so I thought until she said,
"I can't understand a word she's saying."
Savardin's accent and way of speaking would be familiar to most educated Rodchai, from old entertainments and the way Anander Mianai's speech was widely emulated by prestigious, or hopefully prestigious, families. I hadn't thought changes in pronunciation and vocabulary had been so extreme. But I'd lived through them, and Savardin's ear for language had never been the sharpest. "She's offering tea."
"Oh."
Savardin looked briefly at her crossed arms.
"No."
I took the tea the adjunct poured from a flask on the table, thanked her, and took a seat. The office had been painted a pale green, the floor tiled with something that had probably been intended to look like wood, and might have succeeded if the designer had ever seen anything but imitations of imitations. A niche in the wall behind the young adjunct held an icon of Amat and a small bowl of bright orange, ruffle-petaled flowers, and beside that, a tiny brass copy of the cliffside in the Temple of Ikt. You could buy them, I knew, from vendors in the plaza in front of the 4 temple water during pilgrimage season. I looked at the adjunct again. Who was she? Someone I knew? A relative of someone I'd met?
"You're humming again," Savardin said in an undertone.
"Excuse me." I took a sip of tea. "It's a habit I have. I apologize."
"No need," said the adjunct, and took her own seat by the table.
This was, fairly clearly, her own office, and so she was direct assistant to the inspector supervisor. An unusual place for someone so young.
"I haven't heard that song since I was a child."
Savardin blinked, not understanding. If she had, she likely would have smiled. A Rodchai could live nearly 200 years. This inspector adjunct, probably a legal adult for a decade, was still impossibly young.
"I used to know someone else who sang all the time," the adjunct continued.
I knew her, had probably bought songs from her. She would have been maybe 4, maybe 5 when I'd left Oars. Maybe slightly older if she remembered me with any clarity. The inspector supervisor behind that door would be someone who had spent time on Shiserna, in Oars itself, most likely. What did I know about the lieutenant who had replaced Lieutenant On as administrator there? How likely was it she'd resigned her military assignment and taken one as a dock inspector? It wasn't unheard of. Whoever the inspector supervisor was, she had money and influence enough to bring this adjunct here from Oars. I wanted to ask the young woman the name of her patron, but that would be unthinkably rude.
"I'm told," I said, meaning to sound idly curious and playing up my Gerentate accent just the smallest bit,
"that the jewelry you Rachai wear has some sort of significance." Savardin cast me a puzzled look. The adjunct only smiled.
"Some of it."
Her Orsian accent, now I had identified it, was clear, obvious.
"This one, for instance."
She slid one gloved finger under a gold-colored dangle pinned near her left shoulder.
"It's a memorial."
"May I look closer?" I asked, and receiving permission moved my chair near and bent to read the name engraved in Rachai on the plain metal, one I didn't recognize. It wasn't likely a memorial for an Orsian. I couldn't imagine anyone in the lower city adopting Rachai funeral practices, or at least not anyone old enough to have died since I'd seen them last. Near the memorial on her collar sat a small flower pin, each petal enameled with a symbol of an emanation, a date engraved in the flower's center. This assured young woman had been the tiny, frightened flower-bearer when Anander Mee and I had acted as priest in Lieutenant On's house 20 years ago. No coincidences, not for Rachai. I was quite sure now that when we were admitted to the Inspector Supervisor's presence, I would meet Lieutenant On's replacement in Ors. This Inspector Adjunct was, perhaps, a client of hers.
"They make them for funerals," the adjunct was saying, still talking about memorial pins. "Family and close friends wear them."
And you could tell by the style and expense of the piece just where in Rachai society the dead person stood, and by implication, where the wearer stood. But the adjunct, her name I knew, was Douse Kate, didn't mention that. I wondered then what Savardin would make, had made, of changes in fashion since Garsed, the way such signals had changed, or not. People still wore inherited tokens and memorials, testimony to the social connections and values of their ancestors generations back. And mostly that was the same, except generations back was Garsed. Some tokens that had been insignificant then were prized now, and some that had been priceless were now meaningless. And the color and gemstone significances in vogue for the last 100 or so years wouldn't read at all for Savardin. Inspector Adjunct Kate had 3 close friends, all 3 of whom had incomes and positions similar to hers, to judge from the gifts they'd exchanged with her. 2 lovers, intimate enough to exchange tokens with, but not sufficiently so to be considered very serious. No strands of jewels, no bracelets, though of course if she did any work actually inspecting cargo or ship systems, such things might have been in her way, and no rings over her gloves. And there, on the other shoulder, where now I could see it plainly and look straight at it without being excessively impolite, was the token I had been looking for. I had mistaken it for something less impressive, had, on first glance, taken the platinum for silver and its dependent pearl for glass, the sign of a gift from a sibling, current fashions misleading me. This was nothing cheap, nothing casual, but it wasn't a token of clientage, though the metal and the pearl suggested a particular house association. An association with a house old enough that Savardin could have recognized it immediately, possibly had. Inspector Adjunct Kate stood.
"The Inspector Supervisor is available now," she said. "I do apologize for your wait."
She opened the inner door and gestured us through. In the innermost office, standing to meet us, 20 years older and a bit heavier than when I'd last seen her, was the giver of that pin. Lieutenant, no, Inspector Supervisor Skyot Hour. Chapter 18. It was impossible that Lieutenant Skyot would recognize me. She bowed, oblivious to the fact that I knew her. It was strange to see her in dark blue, and so much more sober, more grave than when I'd known her in Oars. An inspector supervisor in a station as busy as this likely never set foot on the ships her subordinates inspected. But Inspector Supervisor Skyot wore almost as little jewelry as her assistant. A long strand of green and blue jewels coiled from shoulder to opposite hip, and a red stone dangled from one ear, but otherwise a similar, though clearly more expensive, scattering of friends, lovers, dead relatives decorated her uniform jacket. One plain gold token hung on the cuff of her right sleeve, just next to the edge of the glove. The placement, that of something she intended to be reminded of, as much for herself to see as anyone else. It looked cheap, machine-made. Not the sort of thing she would wear. She bowed.
Citizen Save Arden, honored Breck, please sit, will you have some tea?
Still effortlessly elegant even after 20 years. Your assistant already offered us tea, thank you, Inspector Supervisor, I said. Inspector Supervisor Skyot looked momentarily at me, and then at Savarden, slightly surprised, I thought. She had been addressing Savarden primarily, thinking of Savarden as the principal person between the two of us. I sat. Savarden hesitated a moment, and then sat in the seat beside me, arms still crossed to hide her bare hands.
I wanted to meet you myself, citizen, Inspector Supervisor Skyot said, when she'd taken her own seat. Privilege of office. It isn't every day you meet someone 1,000 years old.
Savarden smiled, small and tight.
Indeed not, she agreed. And I felt it would be improper for security to arrest you on the dock. Though,
Inspector Supervisor Skyot gestured, placatory, the pin on her cuff flashing once as she did.
You are in some legal difficulty, citizen.
Savarden relaxed, just slightly, shoulders lowering, jaw loosening. Barely detectable unless you knew her. Skyot's accent and mildly deferential tone were having an effect.
I am, Savarden acknowledged. I intend to appeal. There's some question about the matter, then.
Stilted, formal. A query that wasn't a query, but no answer came.
I can take you to the palace offices myself and avoid any entanglement with security.
Of course she could. She'd worked this out with security's chief already.
I'd be grateful.
Savarden sounded more like her old self than I'd heard her in the last year.
Would it be worth asking you to assist me contacting Gare's lord?
Gare might conceivably have some responsibility for this last member of the house it had taken over. Hated Gare, which had absorbed its enemy, Vendai, Savarden's house. Vendai's relations with Auer hadn't been any better than with Gare, but I supposed the request was a measure of just how desperate and alone Savarden was.
Ah.
Inspector Supervisor Skyot winced just slightly.
Auer and Gare aren't as close as they used to be, citizen. About 200 years ago there was an exchange of heirs. The Gare cousin killed herself.
The verb Inspector Supervisor Skyot used implied that it hadn't been an approved, medical-mediated suicide, but something illicit and messy.
And the Auer cousin went mad and ran off to join some cult somewhere.
Savarden made a breathy, amused noise.
Typical.
Inspector Supervisor Skyot raised an eyebrow, but only said, temperately,
It left some bad feeling on both sides. So my connections with Gare aren't what they could be, and I might or might not be able to be helpful to you. And their responsibilities toward you might be difficult to determine,
though you might find that useful in an appeal.
Savardin gestured abortively, arms still tightly crossed, one elbow lifting slightly.
It doesn't sound like it's worth the trouble.
Inspector Supervisor Skyot gestured